And now we welcome Thomas Gilovich. He is a professor of psychology at Cornell University, co-director of the Cornell Center for Behavioral Economics and Decision Research. He is the author of several books and the new book, co-authored with Lee Ross, the new book, The Wisest One in the Room: How You Can Benefit from Social Psychology's Most Powerful Insights, The Wisest One in the Room, by Thomas Gilovich and Lee Ross. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What exactly is social psychology?
Social psychology is the study of everyday social life. Who are we attracted to and why? When do we conform to other people and why? How does propaganda work? How do we behave differently in groups versus by ourselves, and so on? I like to think of it, now I'm biased because I'm a social psychologist, as the topics within psychology that most people are most interested in. Go ahead.
Is wisdom intelligence? I mean, is that a measure or not? Can someone be wise without necessarily being the smartest person in the room?
That's a great question, and that is, in fact, why we titled the book what we did. That is, we're all familiar with someone who we say about people that that person's always trying to come across as the smartest person in the room, to present himself as the smartest person in the room. And it's rare that we would say a person who tries to do that is wise. That is, you can be very smart. In fact, there's a book out called The Smartest Guys in the Room about the people that led Enron into its ran it into the ground. I think everyone would say they were analytically brilliant, but no one would call them wise. And what's the difference? Well, if someone's going to call you wise, you better be smart about people. And if you aren't smart about people, you can say, yeah, that person's analytic, that person's brilliant, but no one's going to call you wise. And no matter what a person wants to do in life, even if you really would rather be in a room by yourself writing code all day, it's still the case that the most important things in your life are going to be other people. And so what we wanted to do in this room was to present to a wide audience some of the most important fundamental principles of social psychology that we thought are useful, that can make our interactions with others go more smoothly and hopefully make us all wiser.
What are some of those interactions that can make things go smoothly?
Well, one, for example, is knowing when motivating people, ourselves or other people, is important or not. One of the founders of social psychology pointed out this idea that when we try to change other people's behavior, what we try to do is push them more, to motivate them in some way. And there are times in which that's totally appropriate. If you're asking your employees, for example, to do something that's fundamentally unpleasant, they might need more motivation, and hiring motivational speakers, etc., may be exactly what's needed. But many times that's not the case. People are already motivated to eat right, get the right amount of exercise, sleep the right amount, and so on, avoid unsafe sex practices, and so on. People are motivated to do that. They just have a hard time translating those good intentions into effective actions. And the insight was, look, when that's the case, don't beat your or other people's heads against the wall trying to motivate them, because they're already motivated. Instead, figure out what's blocking the behavior that you want, and take a close look at the environment and figure out what's blocking it and remove those blocks to create a channel to create more of that behavior. Probably the best example of this that has received some attention in the media is differences in organ donation rates in different European countries. Many European countries, like the United States, have what's called an opt-in program. If you want to be eligible to donate your organs, you have to sign the back of your driver's license. participation rates in those countries are about 10-15%. Other countries have opt-out procedures. You're assumed to be an organ donor. You don't have to be. If you don't want to, you just sign on the back of your driver's license that you don't want to be. Participation rates there are in the high 90s. The difference couldn't be more dramatic than that. Public opinion polls in these different countries show that people embrace organ donation just as much in the opt-in countries versus the opt-out countries. But in the opt-in countries, you've made the behavior just a little bit harder. It's not that hard to sign the back of your driver's license. Nonetheless, we don't get around to it. So the general principle, it's not a motivational problem. If you tried to, come on, people, sign up to be eligible to donate your organs, that probably wouldn't work very much. Instead, make a slight tweak to the environment, the default in this particular case, you get much more of the behavior that you want.
There was also something in there about an honesty statement. If you put the honesty statement at the beginning of a series of questions, people are more likely to answer honestly if they have to sign off that they've filled out the form honestly than if you put the honesty statement at the end of the questions after they've already filled them out.
Yeah, a really dramatic demonstration of the same idea. Before you make a series of statements where you might be tempted to fudge, if you've said, I'm going to be honest now, that's in your head, and you're going to fill it out or be more likely to fill it out honestly. If you fill it out, however you're so inclined at the moment, signing afterwards is kind of too late.
We tend to run across a lot of people that we think are wise, or at least we follow their advice. They give advice. We tend to follow it, whether it's right or wrong sometimes, it seems. And it seems like many times people giving advice, and a lot of people who have many followers following that advice, not necessarily the wisest people in the room, though.
yes, that's certainly true. And there's been a lot of work lately about the wisdom of crowds, and therefore when you're thinking about taking advice, you might not want to consult just one person. You might want to consult several people. And if you do that, it's very important that the different people that you consult truly are different. That is, they aren't all friends of each other, therefore likely to see things the very same way as each other. You want independent contributions to whatever issue you're thinking about.
And we kind of trick ourselves sometimes into thinking that we are getting independent verification, that we are not biased, that we are indeed objective. And I know I'm completely objective. I'm not sure about you, but I am.
Yeah, that's something we talk about in the book as well. Psychologists call this the bias blind spot, that it's very easy for us to see when other people seem to be, their judgment seems to be tainted by self-interest, less so to see it in ourselves. And that, you know, that sounds like a great shortcoming, and it is, but it's also one of those shortcomings that's very understandable. That is to say, when we think about whether we're going to be, if our judgment's going to be biased, we ask ourselves, am I biased? We look inward to try to find any evidence of bias, and you don't really see it. It doesn't leave a phenomenological trace. So you look inward and you think, no, I don't, nothing feels like I was biased, so you conclude you aren't. You can't look inward into someone else. Instead, you look at their external circumstance. Oh, if they come up with this judgment, they stand to benefit in this way, and therefore they seem biased. We're consulting very different information in evaluating the biases of other people than evaluating the biases of ourselves.
And do we tend to get it right about other people?
With respect to how much judgments are biased, yeah, we're much more accurate about other people than ourselves. And again, there's some, I think, interesting and fundamental psychology that's responsible for that. So, for example, if you really back up and just ask the question, what's the purpose of the 3.5 pounds of information processing hardware we have in our skulls. Its number one job is to make sense of the world, and it does so through a lot of different processes, many of them outside of our awareness. And since the making sense of the world happens automatically, non-consciously, what we're left with is the sense that we've detected, not the making part. And therefore, we don't realize the extent to which we've clouded our own judgment. Psychologists refer to this as naive realism. We have the sense that we're seeing the world the way that it is, not seeing our particular take on the world. The best example of this that I know, we do mention this in the book, the comedian George Carlin once asked his audience, have you ever noticed that people driving faster than you are maniacs, and anyone driving slower than you is an idiot? And it's a wise observation, because, of course, we drive according to what our best judgment indicates is the proper speed given these driving conditions. And therefore, almost by definition, subjectively, someone who's driving slower is an idiot. Someone driving faster is a maniac. And that captures an important part of how we go through our lives everywhere, and it makes it easy for us to think that other people are biased. It makes it easy for us to think that we watch a political debate and the commentators seem to be so critical of our candidate and seem to skip over the problems of the opposing candidate. That's another phenomenon that we talk about in the book, the hostile media phenomenon. Both sides, when listening to the same news coverage, think that the coverage is biased against them and is going to make neutral observers turn against their side and favor the opposite side.
But then there is also a difference between bias and adaptation, and humans are really quite good much of the time at adaptation. You gave an example in the book of an athlete injured in an auto accident, became paraplegic, and yet had a great outlook on life, really seemed to be incredibly happy.
Yeah, that's Mark Zupan, who mm-hmm. stars in the film Murderball, I think it's called, and about wheelchair rugby. And his story is not that uncommon. There have been studies done of people who've lost the use of their limbs, and before that happens to you, many people, when they think about that, go, oh, man, I don't know if I'd ever recover. I'm not sure I'd want to live anymore. And, of course, in the immediate aftermath, those people are devastated. It is hellish. But humans have a remarkable capacity for adaptation. And a year later, their levels of happiness are really not much different from the average person. And many people who've lost the use of limbs nonetheless say that their life is close to their ideal.
And many people are constantly looking for something else in life, whether it be in a relationship. Oh, if I could only meet this girl and have a relationship. Oh, if I could only get a promotion. If I could get more money. Higher salary, have a bigger pile of assets. Oh, that would make me happy, but it doesn't always turn out that way. And as we continue this conversation, I'd like to find out why it doesn't always turn out that way and how we can go about actually pursuing happiness and finding happiness. We're talking with Thomas Gilovich. He is co-author along with Lee Ross of a new book, The Wisest One in the Room, How You Can Benefit from Social Psychology's Most Powerful Insights, The Wisest One in the Room. More in just a moment. Money Radio, thank you so much for joining us today. We're talking with Thomas Gilovich, author, co-author of new book, The Wisest One in the Room, How You Can Benefit from Social Psychology's Most Powerful Insights. Right before the break, you gave the example of Mark Zupan, a man who had been injured in an auto accident, paralyzed and yet incredibly happy. So many people think that if I could just get a raise, if I could make more money, I would be happy. Is that true?
You raise a great question, that adaptation, our remarkable capacity for adaptation, is our greatest ally when it comes to negative things. Bad things happen. They're terrible. We feel horrible as a result. But then slowly, but very surely, we get over those and we're back to where we were beforehand. It's a great triumph of the human spirit. At the same time, that same capacity that's our greatest ally when it comes to bad things is a powerful enemy when it comes to good things. We think that, oh, if I just get this raise, I'll be so happy. Or if she just says yes, I'll be the happiest person on the planet. Yeah, you will be for a while, but then you adapt to that, and now you need more. Psychologists refer to this as the hedonic treadmill, like the rat in the cage. You need to keep running and running, acquiring new stuff, getting ever greater accomplishments to get the same level of satisfaction. And that is a powerful barrier to sustained happiness. Evolution, we evolved probably not to be happy beings. We evolved to be striving beings, and that's responsible for the, you know, the phrase everyone's heard, that life is a journey, not a destination. We're happiest when we're striving for things. So,
what does this also tell us about income inequality in this country?
Well, we talk about income inequality in the context of surveying the entire literature on happiness and saying, what are the things that you can do to make yourself happier? And some of the biggest determinants of happiness are things like having rewarding relationships, gratifying work, and those are all things we should all strive for. But you can't simply choose to have better relationships. And so we wanted to focus on things that any individual could simply do. And we think there are three principles that are very helpful in that regard, and then one that we can all do as citizens that has the same result. So, for example, things you can simply decide to do is be active. Teddy Roosevelt used to exhort himself and his kids with the idea of get action, that you're happiest when you're out striving, doing things. And you can simply decide to do that. Secondly, people seem to be happier or get more sustained happiness by investing more in experiences, less in material goods. Not that you have to forswear all material goods and live an ascetic lifestyle, but spend a little more on experiences, a little less on material goods. Research indicates you'll be happier. And with respect to income inequality, it turns out if you look at states or counties across the United States, those counties that have more income inequality are associated with a whole bunch of things that make people less happy. Higher divorce rates, higher bankruptcy rates, longer commutes. People are less happy when income inequality gets too great. And of course, in the global economy in which we now live, it inevitably produces forces exist to produce more and more income inequality. And so the question is, what can we do sensibly to try to not necessarily eliminate it, but rein it in a little bit? And we'd likely be much happier as a result.
It deals with so much. The wisest one in the room. How you can benefit from social psychology's most powerful insights. The Wisest One in the Room by Thomas Gilovich and Lee Ross. Thomas Gilovich, also the author of, and we should probably talk about this at some point, Why Smart People Make Big Money Mistakes. But the new book, The Wisest One in the Room. Thomas, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.